My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we will return to a subject that we have talked about a fair amount over the years, and that is the relationship between India and Pakistan. These two countries have a rather long-standing rivalry and tensions that have waxed and waned over the years. But certainly it seems to be a rivalry that goes right back to the creation of both countries in 1947. They have fought three wars and some lesser battles. And in 2002, there was a great deal of concern that the conflict and a central issue in this conflict being Kashmir, that the conflict might get to the point where the two sides would escalate to using nuclear weapons, and certainly both sides have demonstrated the capability of building them. In recent years, there has been some improvements in relations between the two countries. The two governments certainly seem to be making an effort in that direction. So it remains to be seen how all of this will play out. In this part of the show, we'll be talking a bit about the prospects for peace in South Asia. And our guest is Rafiq Tasani. He is a senior research scholar at the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford University. He's here visiting the campus, his visit co-sponsored by the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, and the Program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. And he'll be giving a talk on the U of I campus this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center on the campus, West Illinois in Urbana. And I'm certain that anyone interested in attending the talk should feel welcome. Here on the program, of course, anyone interested in being a part of this conversation should feel welcome, too, to call into the program. 333-9455. That's the number for people who are here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Maybe also would mention a recent book on the subject that we're talking here about this morning that might interest you. It's entitled Prospects for Peace in South Asia. It was published in 2005 by the Stanford University Press. Also, our guest is author of an earlier book, Telecommunications Reform in India. That's the title, published in 2002 by Greenwood Press. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think that it is true that in recent years, over the past few years, that the two governments, the governments of India and Pakistan, have been making an effort to improve relations, to lessen tensions. And there have been some openings in the area of transportation, for example, when making it easier for people to go back and forth between India and Pakistan. And so it seems as if the two governments are certainly making an effort. Would it be fair to say that that a positive effort has been made, and let us say that now here in 2006, relations are better than they were in 2002?
Yes, I think so. I think it's fair to also say that people are puzzled. You know, the trajectory of India-Pakistan relations has waxed hot and cold several times over the last 60 years, roughly, since independence in 1947. And there have been times when things have been warm, as now, and warming up. I mean, in the 60s, for example, you know, air travel and so on was quite frequent. And today, we still don't have that freedom of travel between India and Pakistan that was there then. But considering that both sides have tested nuclear weapons, that just in 2002, they came very close to a nuclear war, I think one can safely say there's been a huge change for the better.
It's certainly, we have seen in both countries, I think, a very strong sense of nationalist identity. People very strongly feeling that they are Pakistani, that they are Indian, and there is a division along religious lines. How important that is, I'm not sure. Pakistan being predominantly Muslim and India being predominantly Hindu, but you also might have to say, or it seems that both these countries should have more in common than they have dividing them. Why? How would one explain this long-running kind of rivalry, as I said, and I think this is true, virtually going back, absolutely going back to the time, to 1947, when the countries came into being.
Yes, you see, 1947, when they went to war over Kashmir, that created a perception within Pakistan, which was confirmed in their minds in, I would say, with the Bangladesh separation in 1971, that India could not accept Pakistan as a country. It's a sort of hard for people of Indian origin to accept this, because, you know, in my own case, having grown up in India, where the sense of nationalism was based on a sense of territorial integrity, that is, the flag and the nation are one. So it wasn't a religious concept. You're right that India is predominantly Hindu, 85% are Hindu, and a sense of Hindu identity has been developing, though not as strongly as its protagonists would want, probably since the early 1990s. So it's less than two decades old. So the population of India, by and large, have accepted that vision of India as where the nation and the flag and the territory are one. So it's based on citizenship. And the question that Indians ask of Pakistan is that your concept of nationhood as well? Whereas the Pakistani view is different. I mean, they do not see themselves as a theocratic country in the sense where Islam dominates politics. You know, there have been several surveys. My own work has shown that to be the case. Yet they have faced a much more severe problem of Islamic fundamentalism historically over 50 years than India has. And that's been one of the key sticking points in their relationship. I think there's plenty of blame to go around on both sides. Pakistan for supporting the insurgency in Kashmir, but then India for letting that insurgency and its root cause happen in the first place. So I think their dispute has happened because you've had forces at work going back to independence that in a way they couldn't control. You know, the appalling poverty that both countries inherited at independence, which led them to react in certain ways. India differently from Pakistan, of course. But that led to these conflicts.
For most of India's history after independence, one political party was the dominant party, the Congress Party. Then in 1996, the BJP, a fundamentalist, a Hindu nationalist party, I should say, came to power. And then there was another change of government. This was in 2004, where the Congress Party came back into power once again. If you look at the two changes of government here going back to 1996, were there some important ways in which the change, either the initial change from Congress to the BJP and then now 2 years ago back the other direction, did the relationship between India and Pakistan, how was it shaped by which of the two parties happened to be in power at the time?
So, in my opinion, what really changed the relationship was the era of coalition government. The BJP had participated in a coalition government as early as 1977 at the center in New Delhi. But it was really only in 1989 when the Congress government, as a monolithic dominant presence over Indian politics, finally ended as that presence. And ever since then, whether it's been the BJP or the Congress now in power, it's been through coalitions. So really what's changed in India is the era of coalition government has come to stay. It's not been so much that the Hindu Nationalist Party, the BJP, has been in power and that's affected India-Pakistan relations. It's that coalition government has created a different set of dynamics in the India-Pakistan relationship. Because what coalition government has done is it's federalized government. So there's much more power now with the states, the individuals, you know, the provinces, the states, than with New Delhi. And with that, there's been a weakening of central power. And so their ability to take the nation with them on grand initiatives, whether it be opposing Pakistan, is much, much less. And I think that created the context for improved relationships between the two countries.
We have callers. We would get them in here in just a moment. I probably should introduce again the guest. We're talking with Dr. Rafiq Dasani. He is a senior research scholar at the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center, which is at Stanford University, and visiting the campus here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the relationship between Pakistan and India. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll start here with someone in Indiana, line number four. Hello.
Hello. If this is germane, I'd like for you to say something about, at least pull together in some way, the Pakistani scientist who, handed out, nuclear information to different peoples, and the recent trip by Bush cementing some kind of agreement that the United States will give information in regard to civilian use of nuclear energy. I just wonder how that's playing out, what importance you think it is, and what are the ramifications are, if at all, germane. Thanks.
Thank you for that question. So you're referring to the scientist in Pakistan, A.Q. Khan, who, operating his own laboratory, used clandestine methods to gather both nuclear equipment and knowledge as well as distribute it outside the country. It's useful to remember Pakistan's condition then as a pariah state shunned by all in post the first Afghan invasion, which ended with the end of the Soviet era. You know, for that decade of the 1990s, Pakistan was really a non-entity in world affairs, and still faced with what it viewed as a strong India threat, felt that it had to accumulate or at least acquire nuclear weaponry. And despite what the government of Pakistan might say about not knowing about A.Q. Khan's methods, my sense is that there was awareness. But then the question becomes, why is it that the Bush administration is so close to Pakistan? Of course, the civilian nuclear energy deal is with India, not with Pakistan. And so to answer the first question, why the Bush administration is still so close to Pakistan, even to the extent of providing them with nuclear deployment controls in a way to make their nuclear weaponry safer, the answer, I think, is fairly straightforward. Pakistan is the front line in America's war against global terror, as it appears in the Middle East, particularly in that portion of the extreme South Asia, which is Afghanistan, and really has, in terms of what it can do, it can only do these things with Pakistan's assistance. There was a good statement in the Pakistani press which said that, you know, the reason why the U.S. is close to Pakistan is that Pakistan worries the U.S. The reason why it's getting close to India is because India interests the U.S. And so that explains the civilian nuclear program with India, where the difference between Pakistan is that the U.S. would like to view India as a strategic partner, that is, someone whom they can take joint decisions with. It's quite different from a tactical partner, which is what Pakistan is to the U.S.
Here, I think it's very interesting, and you've laid this out, I think, in very nice, neat, and clear, and brief, that the United States, it's interested in having a positive relationship, obviously, with both countries. And the United States is, I think, and other countries are well interested in non-proliferation. So they're interested in trying to limit the spread of nuclear weapons and technology. But that other than that, the interest in the relationship between the two countries is different. And as you say, on the one hand, and as far as Pakistan is concerned, the United States has always considered this to be an important piece in the war against terror, what is being called the war against terror. And of course, was going back to the time back far enough when the Soviets were in Afghanistan, Pakistan was a very important to the United States in its effort to aid those people in Afghanistan who were fighting to get out the Russians. So there's that. And as far as India is concerned, the relationship does indeed seem to be somewhat different their economic interests and so forth. Does the United States and its various interests when the two countries are concerned, does that at all complicate the relationship between the two? I mean, is that actually pose some problems for the two governments of India and Pakistan?
I think it poses enormous problems. Despite what the Pakistanis have said about the U.S.-India agreement on nuclear fuel supply, that, you know, that's between the U.S. and India, we have our own relationship with the U.S., I think they're enormously worried, and not without good reason. There is, you know, India's 8 out of their 22 nuclear facilities will be outside the scope of international inspection. And of course, all of Pakistan's will be outside. But that still leaves enough space for as big an arms race as both sides and the whole world should be scared of. In some estimates, India could now make up to 50 deployable nuclear weapons a year with the facilities that they have, which will be outside the safeguards. From the American point of view, it was something is better than nothing. And it was a price, in a way, they had to pay for their past indifference to India, in a way. I mean, India has never really trusted the U.S. Ever since, I would say, from 1947 onwards till now. And it's required the U.S. to take a series of fairly sort of significant hard steps. Many such have been taken. This is just one, the 2002 crisis diffusion, the 1999 Kargil. I mean, these were the three steps that the U.S. took, which sort of have been part of a process of convincing India that it is a serious long-term partner.
Let's talk with another caller. This next will be in Bloomington, Indiana, on our line number 2. Hello.
Hello. You mentioned that both Pakistan and Bangladesh have separated from India. Would you outline the history of why these separations occurred?
Yes, certainly. Actually, at the time of independence, Bangladesh was part of Pakistan. It was the territory that Jinnah called this moth-eaten piece of land where he was given... Jinnah was the founder of Pakistan. And so there were two parts to Pakistan. One was on the east and one was on the west of India, roughly with equal population, somewhat higher on the eastern side, which became Bangladesh. The rulers of Pakistan, however, chose to... They were all from northern India, and then they moved over to what was then West Pakistan. And when that happened, over a period of time, undoubtedly there was a period of, you can say, neglect of the East, even brutal repression of even democratic impulses in the East, culminating in an election in 1969 where essentially it was a free, fair election where the Bangladesh group, what is now Bangladesh, but East Pakistan, then a party gained enough votes to rule the whole country, East and West. And that was untenable from the West Pakistan point of view, particularly the military. And so they brutally suppressed that situation. There was an uprising in East Pakistan, actively supported, abetted by India, leading to the dismemberment of the country into what is now Bangladesh on the east and Pakistan on the west. And Pakistan never really quite forgiven India for its role in that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Right. Was there, how much it was absolutely the creation of Pakistan driven by the feelings of Muslims that they weren't going to be treated fairly in a state that was majority Hindu, and that there needed to be a state, a Muslim state?
So this is a very interesting question because, it, for one thing, the assumption that Muslims in some way are all similar within India is not true. Mm-hmm. There was no common Muslim feeling, you know, and sort of it resonates with the current situation where there's so much plurality within Islam that to say that Muslims feel one way or another is never actually the case. But certainly at the time of independence, there was a large section of the Muslims in the north led by Muhammad Ali Jinnah who, for various reasons, for example, his relationship with Gandhi, which was complex, with Nehru, which was even more complex, felt that Muslims would not get a fair stake in an undivided India. And he then led the move convincing the British that you needed this separate countries situation. And the history goes back earlier to the Khilafat movement, but I won't get into those details. But what I wanted to point out was that the mass of migration that took place into Pakistan when a new country, these two countries were created, was from the north. The Muslims in the southern part of India, it was from the north and from the east. The Muslims in the southern part of India, say states like Kerala, Karnataka, Tamil Nadu and so on, who were as well settled as the Muslims in Delhi or in the north, they chose not to move. And you can see that difference even today. You can see it in that the leadership and the elite of the Muslims who moved out from the north left the much poorer, less educated Muslims behind in the north, creating the whole slew of problems that ultimately led to Hindutva in some sense. Whereas in the south, the Hindu nationalist movement has never taken off because the Muslims who stayed behind were deeply integrated, they were well settled, and they formed a community that worked closely with everyone else.
Let us continue, and I think we have another caller here to talk with, and this is in here in Champaign-Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, I'm on cell phone, so I apologize for any comments breaking in out. My question is this. The Indian government has always used China as an excuse to develop nuclear weapons, and the U.S. government is willing to give India nuclear technology to contain and counterbalance China. China and India has been neighbors for many years, for thousands of years, actually. My question is, how much threat does India feel from China, and what role is India willing to play vis-à-vis containing China?
Well, that's a good question. I talk frequently to Indian foreign policymakers, and there's no better way to empty a room of Indian foreign policymakers than to raise the question of the China threat to India. They just don't buy it. There's enormous reservoir of goodwill despite the 1961 war that India and China went through. There's an enormous reservoir of goodwill towards China within India. And if you look at the nuclear weapons development by India and how it's been deployed, and everything is gained to deter, everything has been done to really manage its relationship with Pakistan. It is not designed to be aggressive towards China. For example, the missiles that India has cannot reach strategic locations in China. I mean, it's clearly an India-Pakistan affair that's happened, and as well as deterring attacks from anyone else, certainly. So I would say that the U.S. has its own agenda to want to counter China because it sees China's rising military expenditure, its concept of what should be the ruling power, the sort of hegemonistic view of the world, doesn't allow for that much space for a strong, militarily strong China, which is not how China sees its destiny in terms of one of the global elite. And India's view is quite different from the U.S. view. But that said, I mean, India wants nuclear fuel for its nuclear energy. China is a member of the nuclear suppliers group on whose behalf the U.S. is committed to supply nuclear fuel. You should remember that this agreement is not U.S.-India, it's actually U.S. agreeing not just on its own behalf, but on behalf of all the countries of the nuclear suppliers group, which means they have to convince them, but China is one of those members, that this should be done. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. We're at our midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Rafiq Dosani. He is a senior research scholar at the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford University. He's here visiting to talk about this very subject. We'll be giving a talk this afternoon on the U of I campus at the Levis Faculty Center. That's at 4 o'clock, co-sponsored by the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, and also the Program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies here at University of Illinois. He is the author of the book Prospects for Peace in South Asia, co-edited with Henry Rowan, the published last year by Stanford University Press. Also, he's author of the book Telecommunications Reform in India, published in 2002. He is, by his training, an economist, educated in India and also at the United States. Here he has a PhD from Northwestern, a PhD in finance from Northwestern University. Questions welcome as we continue to talk. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There was probably no single issue that is a more of a sore point between India and Pakistan than Kashmir. And it's a very complicated situation because there are so many different interests here. India feels that it's part of India. Pakistan feels, at least in as much as there are Muslims living there, that at least part of it, should be part of Pakistan. There are Buddhist Kashmiris who, you know, maybe have another set of interests. And of course, there are people within Kashmir who think that it should be independent. And there is still now this long-running dispute about the circumstances at the independence of India, of how it is that Kashmir became part of India at all. So, and I know from having talked about this with various people over the years that if you ask 10 different people about this, you're going to get 10, maybe more, different kinds of takes on it. Having said all that, what do you think the prospects are of managing to find a solution that is going to satisfy mostly everybody here?
Okay, so let me give my, let me offer the 11th point of view.
Okay, good.
So I think the facts are not really disputed, but interpretation counts. So, for example, India concedes that it agreed before the UN that there would be a vote taken by the Kashmiris to decide on their future. Mm-hmm. But it also says that in 1965 and 1971, when Pakistan essentially lost the wars with India, Pakistan agreed to go back on the need for such a vote and agreed that all future resolutions would be bilateral. So that's you can say, I don't know if it's a fig leaf, but that's the excuse that India gives. I think the reality perhaps is that one should ask, what do the Kashmiri people want? I mean, if that's our question on a moral basis, that what the Kashmiri people want should be what's done, and has what they want changed substantially with time, or has it been fairly constant? And if it's been fairly constant with time, it would reinforce the moral strength of the argument that what they want now is what should be done. So I think what they want, and I'm basing my opinion of what they want, and I freely say it's an opinion, based on discussions I've had with people in the Kashmir Liberation Front, with others, with Indian policymakers, some Pakistani policymakers. My sense is what the Kashmir people want is independence. It's a long-running, India would call it a sub-nationalism. The Kashmiris would call it their nationalism, Kashmiriyat, or Kashmiri culture, which transcends religion. And by the way, just to clear up this point about Buddhist or non-Muslim Kashmiris, about 77% of the population of what is now Indian Kashmir is Muslim. Mm-hmm. One will always say that the rights of the others should be respected, but it's very hard to do that when they all live together. But what the Kashmiris are saying is that theirs is not a demand based on religion. They want to be independent. They don't want to go with either Pakistan or with India. Pakistan insists that if a choice was given between just two and not the third choice of independence, India or Pakistan, that the Kashmiris would opt to go with Pakistan. India, I think, recognizes, and which is why it's not pushing for a vote or doesn't want a vote, doesn't want any international involvement, that if a vote was held today, at least Kashmiris would choose not to go with India. Whether they would go for Pakistan independence, my view is they would go for independence. But what India is hoping for is that ultimately the nationalism that is Kashmir or the sub-nationalism that is Kashmir will dissipate over time, just as many other sub-nationalisms often dissipate in the face of economic growth. And that if India over the next 20, 25 years becomes a much stronger country than Pakistan, then Kashmiris would of their own volition choose to be part of India rather than Pakistan. I mean, if I was a politician, which thankfully I'm not, I would argue that at the very least one should sort of open up relationships between Kashmir, between two sides of Kashmir, which, by the way, are not that ethnically similar as is often thought. The Kashmiris in the valley have more to do with the non-Kashmir, with the non-Muslim Kashmiris culturally than they, in many cases, they have to do with some parts of Pakistan Kashmir. And we can get into more detail if you like. But I think that's the way to go. So incrementally improve relationships, you know, trade, commerce. Those things are happening now, as you pointed out at the beginning. And, you know, defer the question of a plebiscite or a free vote for some time until people really have a decade or two of stability and peace to think about these issues and to make their decisions from a position of strength.
Mm-hmm. It would seem that here, one thing that I certainly know that is true is the people who study and follow this region have been, particularly in the last few years, or at least since both states here developed their nuclear capability, have said to the rest of the world, this is an important place. Don't forget this. Don't leave it off your list. This is a conflict. The India-Pakistan conflict is one that has great potential for great disruption in the region if it gets out of hand. So it's something that we need to pay attention to. And that this particular issue is one that's it's a real problem. It's been a problem between the two countries for a long time. So it's one that also needs attention. Though at the same time, it seems that this is something that the rest of the world just doesn't really pay a great deal of attention to. And it sounds as if the long-term strategy, particularly on the Indian side, is essentially to kind of hope things sort of – almost hope the conflict kind of goes away. Mm. That doesn't really sound like that if there's no particular international interest in really moving things along. And if the Indians at least are hoping that given time, it'll get to the point where it's not an issue anymore. I mean, that really makes it sound like nothing really is likely to happen much here.
Well, actually, things are happening, although Pakistan is playing less and less of a role in the process. You see, what happened is that, if you remember, I talked about this sort of age of coalition government.
Mm-hmm.
When that happened, I think our Indian policymakers and politicians saw the value of a decentralized polity. And so what you had in 2002 under the BJP, so this Hindu Nationalist Party, you had for the first time in 15 years the first fair elections in Kashmir. And that's why the insurgency's come down. For the first time, the people of Kashmir after 15 years, which spanned the insurgency, saw that New Delhi was giving them a chance to express their view fairly. And so the party that came into power, which incidentally is a coalition of the Congress Party and another local party, is trusted by the local people. And that's why the insurgency has come down. So it's nothing to do with Pakistan supporting it less or more. I mean, there's just less demand for the insurgency locally because people are saying, all right, you know, we're tired of violence. Let's give it a chance and see how things improve. Now, India, New Delhi at least, has to perform. And I think there's an incentive to perform because India realizes as a sort of a future great power, which is what it wants to be and has wanted to be since independence, is now finally possible. Maybe not in the next 10, 20 years, maybe in the next 50, 60 years. And no great power has these sorts of border issues. And it must resolve that by accommodation if necessary. And to point out, worth pointing out that in surveys done in India of what the rest of India thinks about accommodating on Kashmir, there's overwhelming support for accommodation. Give them their own land if that's what they want. People are not, in India, are not territorial in that sense at all.
You know, that's interesting because I guess my understanding was that in India there was a strong sense that Kashmir was part of India and should stay that way, just in the same way that on a sort of a popular level within Pakistan, there was this strong sense that, well, Kashmir, it's predominantly Muslim, and Pakistan, this is the country that was created to be the home for Muslims. So that means that really, at least that a big part of Kashmir really should be part of Pakistan. So for what you're saying, though, is that you think in India that it's just not – not that big an issue and that people really don't, there would not be a lot of opposition to the idea of an independent Kashmir.
It would have to be positioned right. What the surveys I'm referring to are those taken by well-known organizations, for example, the India Today Group, which is a very respected newspaper group, sort of on par with credibility with, say, the New York Times or something, has done these surveys showing that if in the interests of peace, accommodation has to be given autonomy, and there are various ways you can do that. You know, the Delhi Agreement of 1952 between Sheikh Abdullah of Kashmir and Prime Minister Nehru, which gave a huge amount of autonomy, would be the first step to do that. And then, depending on what the Kashmiris wanted, they could go further on. I think the people of India recognize that cultures exist, and the Kashmiris are a very odd piece of land where, for various reasons, you never had British rule. You know, you had a suzerainty towards British rule, but it was able to retain its culture for many, many hundreds of years. And therefore, in that sense, developed differently from India. I think people know that, you know, they're well aware of that. Of course, you have counter trends as well. And so if you have a bunch of terrorist attacks, for example, at a particular point within the heartland of India, then people's views will, at least for that period of time, change. But I think in an environment of peace and stability, the overwhelming Indian view is accommodation.
I mentioned at one point, or maybe it was just the last time I reintroduced you, about your background as an economist, so that it seems natural to ask some questions about the Indian economy. And certainly one of the big stories when it comes to India in recent years has been its economic growth. And I know certainly there are people who say, remark upon today, say the economic dominance of the United States and on the world stage, would say that maybe in another, who knows, 20 years, 30 years, that the economies of India and also China, and I think some people would include Brazil perhaps, would grow to the point where we would truly be talking about a much more multipolar world in an economic sense, and that these economies would have grown to the point where they would rival that of the United States. I don't think anybody's saying that the United States is going away, but that there would be other nations or potentially blocks of nations that would be that have that kind of potential. You see that for India?
Yes, I do, with some caveats. I mean, one thing I'd like to point out is that this would be a good thing. I mean, no one complains if, say, Spain becomes prosperous or Portugal becomes prosperous, because it's viewed that they, you know, their prosperity helps the prosperity of the rest of the world. And I think people should view countries like India and China in that light, that their rising prosperity increases trade, it increases the demand for goods and services generally, some of which will be fulfilled from the United States. I think the worry in the United States over here is that we would lose out because we're doing work that they can do more cheaply. In other words, in a sense, our success has been on the backs of those who were not competent to do the work because their systems were bad. When actually we were doing low-level work that they can easily do. I think that's a disservice to the U.S. and that actually there's enough talent, capability, institutions that are far more mature that will enable them to succeed in this competitive world, just as they succeeded when Europe unified. No one complained about that in terms of bringing down the U.S. So that's one part of it. The other side, the caveat is, I certainly see China going that way very fast. You know, China in about 20 years will have a population demography in terms of rural, urban, and you know, mix, in terms of industry, services, agriculture mix, that will start to look like Western countries. India is very, very far from that. Okay, in India today, 70% of the people live in the rural areas. About 300 million people live on less than a dollar a day. It's going to take 50, 60, 70 years before the rural-urban problem even begins to look reasonable. And so I think, you know, India's prowess is real. But it's sort of where China was in the early 1980s. So it's about 20, 25 years behind China. I would even put it back to where Japan was in after the Meiji Restoration. I mean, it's much more like that in its rural-urban mix. And so it's got many, many years to go for catch-up before it really begins to threaten anyone in terms of its economic prowess.
And when people in Pakistan look at India and see this potential, is there And some people a sense that they're or worry that, or say a feeling that Pakistan should have potential, maybe not that kind of potential, but should have potential, and at the same time a worry that somehow it's going to be left behind.
Well, really speaking, Pakistan should have the same potential as India. I mean, it's a huge country. It may be dwarfed in terms of not having a billion people, but it has 150 million people. I mean, it's still huge by any standards, certainly compared to Brazil. And, you know, it's significant even compared to Russia. So it has, you know, it has education levels that are very good, as you can probably see on this campus with the number of students in different fields from Pakistan who do very well, on par with their compatriots from different countries around the world. So I think Pakistan's issue is different. I mean, it really has to figure out how to get these institutions, you know, of democracy, of federalism, of civil rights movement, civil society, working in its favor rather than hitherto working against it. And I think Pakistan's big challenge has been the India threat, which post-1998, after they both acquired nuclear weapons, has all but disappeared. And there's no real reason why I think the military and the civilians should not be able to now negotiate an arrangement which slowly which results in a slow reduction in military power over the next 3 or 4 years and brings back civilians. You know, unfortunately, Pakistan's problem has been the way that military coups have destroyed civilian governance. So if you go into the bureaucracy in Pakistan, there's nothing there. It's just except for the foreign ministry. You know, you go one level beyond the minister and his immediate consultants, there's no depth. So, for example, when I was advising the Pakistan government on telecommunications issues based on work that I had done here and on India, I found it very hard to communicate because there was no civilian bureaucracy which could carry institutional memory, could respond to notes based on what had happened earlier. So they need to build up these institutions over the next 5 to 10 years. And then I think there's no reason why they can't compete on an equal basis with any country in the world.
We have a caller. We'll get right to this caller. Let me just again introduce the guest, Dr. Rafiq Dasani. He's Senior Research Scholar at the Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford University. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign County, line one.
Hi. This worry about the Brazil, India, I forget the acronym people are using these days, but it seems to be just sort of a reification of or of something, some kind of regeneration of the whole idea of the threat of the non-aligned movement. I think the idea that India was in so allied with the Soviets during the East-West conflict, which I always thought was really a cover for the North-South conflict myself, and I'm not sure if Northwestern Economics Department allowed you to keep that kind of idea, because it's not something that that's talked about much in economics schools. But I don't know if you're catching my drift, but the U.S. wants to dominate as every imperial power does. It seems it does it through different modalities, bureaucratic when it can, and economic when it can, and in Iraq the way it's doing it now. So I don't know how you can react to that, but I listen to a lot of grassroots groups out of India, and they have a completely different orientation to the so-called modernization, which was introduced by the BJP when they were in their plurality. But I also, you know, I don't know how much time you can spend on that, but I would like to know what's happened to the BJP. They still have various provinces, Gujarat, et cetera, I think. And I wonder what you think about how volatile the situation is, because they went from having two members in parliament to having a plurality and being able to do a coalition government, right? What's the chances of them coming back in any way? So those two disparate questions, I guess.
Sure, I'll take a stab at most of these. The grouping that you were talking about is the BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And by the way, after completing my PhD at Northwestern, I chose to teach for a couple of years here, but then here, meaning at Penn State, and then decided to go back to India and became a journalist. So I haven't been that tainted by Robert Gordon and company. My view is that the poverty in India is a reality, as I just mentioned, and that's why the BJP lost the 2004 elections, that people saw that economic growth wasn't going to the rural areas, it wasn't going even to the urban middle class. For example, the total figures for employment didn't change at all during the 5 years of the BJP's rule, and this is urban employment. And so in the context of a rising population, there was no increase in employment, and that's why people, even in the cities, voted against the BJP. So that's the reality of India, and I presume the grassroots groups that you talk to echo that sort of experience of this massive digital divide, the massive urban-rural divide that is very real. So I agree with you that it is, in some sense, a north-south conflict that the U.S. is worried about and is trying to manage. And the question for India's politicians, after all, they are responsible in a democracy, is how to manage their relations with the U.S. and to keep it going well, because, 70%, for example, of India's outsourcing business is given to them by American companies, and they don't want to lose that because it's a great source of income, it's a source of learning, it's a source of employment. Turning to the question of what happened to the BJP, well, the BJP, after the 2004 elections, went into a state of internal inquiry because they couldn't believe first that they had lost. It was not expected even in the opinion polls that they would lose. Some of them advocated, sort of led by the more moderate Prime Minister Vajpayee, that they should continue on their path of moderation and start to look more like the Congress and offer an alternative, but keep, their strategy had been sort of be soft at the national level and be a little harder at the state level. So in Gujarat, they could, engender the riots and do the massacre that happened there. But at the center, they were extraordinarily, much unexpectedly moderate. So that's one school of thought. The other school of thought is to change completely and go back into deep Hindutva roots that initially, in a way, led to a doubling of their vote share in the 1991 elections to 20% from 11% in 1989. That was the Ayodhya agitation effect. So that's the other inquiry that's going on. And I think it's an interesting process that's not yet been resolved within the BJP, which is why its external manifestations in terms of, either agitations or action against the U.S., agitating against this deal, which they think is not that good for India, the U.S. nuclear fuel deal, has been very muted because they themselves are in a state of internal disarray. Whether they will get back into array, so to speak, and what that means in terms of their policies, very hard to predict at this state. At this stage, I don't think even they themselves know which way it's going to go. So wait and watch, I would, my sense.
I want to thank the caller. We have one more I want to try to get in at least quickly here. Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Nice program. I'm from Pakistan, and I just have some comments. India and Pakistan, they both are just using the people, especially Pakistan, I can say the military, they just try to use the people to fearness that India is going to get attacked and we're going to get attacked from India, and they're just trying to manipulate the people. Can I get answered?
So you're asking whether they're trying to manipulate the people?
Okay. Get in power, especially the military in Pakistan, because...
So
last time I remember, the Pervez Musharraf and Mr. Vajpayee came to Pakistan, he didn't even shake the hand when the Nawaz Sharif government was there.
So manipulating people is a common tactic of politicians everywhere. I think In this country, you can find it. You can find it certainly in India, where, for example, Mrs. Gandhi's Garibi Hatao campaign in 1967, Remove Poverty, was a manipulation of the people. The bank nationalizations were manipulation of the people. So I think the military in Pakistan is politicized. It understands that to achieve its goal, which is to stay in power, it needs to engender frequent crises, for one. And second is it needs to unify the country against a common problem. In India, that common problem was poverty. The military found an easier one in India. Not to say that there wasn't some reality behind it. I mean, we saw the dismemberment of the country in 71 and various other episodes. So as I was saying at the beginning, no one is really, if you want to put blame, you can blame everyone around. I think the real question is whether the army in Pakistan has kept the country unified and integrated where civilian politicians would not have. And I think that's a question that, in a way, is a good question to ask. And my sense is that, unlike India, where civilian politicians played a significant role from the beginning, they were a mature polity from the beginning, there was land reform from the beginning, I'm talking of post-1947, Pakistan never saw all that, So civilian politicians, those that came into power in Pakistan invariably represented landed or feudal interests with very little interest in the broader interests of the country. And that's what the military kept objecting to. So in a sense, it was a losing game because they would take over saying that these politicians are unfit to run the country, and they were right. But then by doing that, they never allowed politics to mature. And so you've never had the case that civilian politicians are ready to run the country. So this is where the cycle has to be broken somewhere. You need 3 or 4 cycles of elections and time. I think Bangladesh actually is showing the way, in a way, for Pakistan to emulate in this respect.
My apologies for jumping in on you there, but we're simply going to have to stop because we've come to the end of our time. We want to say thanks to our guest, Dr. Rafiq Dasani, from the Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford. He's here visiting the campus. I also do indeed want to mention this is part of the initiative on globalization of the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus. They're the main sponsor. I did mention the co-sponsors. This is an event. He'll be giving a talk on the subject this afternoon at 4 at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. Anyone interested should feel welcome to attend. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
The broadcast today made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta at 114 West Church in Champaign and the staff there at The Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. The broadcast also made possible by 10,000 Villages. Their 14th annual showcase of fair trade oriental rugs will be held through March 11th at their store, 105 North Walnut, downtown Champaign. For more information, call 352-8200. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program.